the people who stand up in mosques in the UK and incite violence against my country, incite violence against Jews, incite violence against minorities, yeah, I'm against them. Everything in the society changes when you introduce violence as a permissible tool. And violence is on the cards in countries like Britain.
Welcome back to State of a Nation. I'm Alon Levy. In the first half of our episode, I sat down with Douglas Murray to discuss the state of our nation, talking to Douglas as someone whose clear voice has been cutting through the noise since October 7th. And here's part two of our episode. Please join us here in Tel Aviv for a fascinating conversation about the new anti-Semitism sweeping Europe, Moynihan's Law, the rules of war, the so-called two-state solution, and more. If you missed the first part and want to catch up, click on the link in the description or visit our channel page. On with the conversation with Douglas Murray.
Breaking news out of Israel this morning.
Shocking hostage taking.
Hundreds of Israelis are dead.
I want to bring in Israeli government spokesman.
What happens when the four-day pause?
How do you resolve this?
Where does this go?
You can't
Douglas, this, just a few days before we recorded this podcast, a statement by the prime ministers of Australia, Canada, and New Zealand calling for a permanent ceasefire, in which they said a ceasefire cannot be unilateral. The hostages must be released immediately and Hamas must lay down its arms. To which I said, well, fantastic. That is called total victory. And that is what we are fighting to achieve. But what do you want us to do if Hamas is going to ignore your polite communique and not release hostages in exchange for aid? And so I'm wondering, why do you think it is so difficult for them to say, we want Israel to win this war?
Well, I think it's because of, I mentioned earlier, what they perceive to be domestic political pressure. Kamala Harris seems to think that domestic political pressure in America over the actions of Israel could cost them a couple of seats at the forthcoming elections. In Australia, the first Muslim Australian minister appointed to the government, in this government, and going back to what I said earlier, why is it this, what's the driver of this in Muslim anti-Semitism? This first Australian Muslim cabinet member came out against Israel early on, altered Australia's vote at the UN, as far as I can see, where nothing changed in the wording put before the Security Council, but Australia went from abstaining to voting for it. There was no such thing at that point as collective cabinet responsibility, which there should have been. As far as I can see, this man got his way. And I think that that is going on.
There's domestic political pressure that is making it difficult for Western countries to pursue what they regard as being their own vital national security interests.
There are two dynamics at play here, as far as I see it. One is on negotiating with two partners. If you have somebody who hates you and is never going to listen to you, and somebody who loves you and listens to you, who might you be at risk of talking to more?
Go on.
It's a second. If you have people in your society who are virulent anti-Semites, virulent, whether Muslim or non-Muslim, so virulent they are willing to go out week after week and shout and shout. And if you have those people, and on the other hand, the people with passion on the other side are filled with decency, respect, courtesy, things that are actually the founding blocks of civilization. Again, who might impress themselves upon you more? When a Jewish pro-Israel event happens, I did a fundraiser for a university in London the other week. And at the end of the event, in London, mainly Jewish audience, we sang Hatikva and then God Save the King.
Yes, we had the same. I was in London for the 100-day rally after the war and addressed the rally in Trafalgar Square, and it ended with Hatikva and God Save the King. And it was so moving to sing both of those together.
Yes. And by the way, I say this in part because have any of the protests of the so-called pro-Palestinians, why do none of them finish with God Save the King? It's because none of these protesters want God to save the King. These are not people who are pro-British. It comes back to my point. These are not people pro-Western or pro-British in any way. They would hate to sing the national anthem of my country. But the point, just to come back to this point, people underestimate the way in which a very virulent minority of people can change the weather. If I came around to your house and I made a demand of you, if I said, Elon, I would like to borrow a cup of sugar.
Or go for it, Douglas.
A bottle,
anything for you.
A bottle of gin.
Go for it.
And if you said, if I said, would you,
God knows
would
you, we owe would you a bottle of gin.
Okay, well, okay. Well, I'm going to take you up on that. this vodka is not very good.
You know, we did actually have a discussion before the podcast whether we should sit here with a whiskey and decided not to do it in the end.
But look, it would totally change the tenor of the discussion if I asked to borrow a cup of sugar or a bottle of gin and I was sitting with a baseball and standing there with a baseball bat like this.
Right.
Right. Totally changes it. Totally changes it. Everything in the society changes when you introduce violence as a permissible tool in the society. And violence is on the cards in countries like Britain.
What do you mean?
Well, groups like Muslims Against the Crusades stand on the streets of London calling for the Muslim armies to arise. Now, I don't think that's a nice, peaceful thing to ask for. Doesn't sound to me like it's being said in a very pacifist tone of voice. When you get people calling for intifada on the streets of London, and as you know, we've had a taste of intifada on the streets of London, so I do not like being talked to in that tone of voice. When you have people on the streets of London calling for intifada, that is likely.
Ironically, on the tube, right? They're calling for suicide bombings on public transport while they're riding the tube.
And then there are the people who are calling simultaneously for a ceasefire and intifada. We don't know how those people's brains work. But
well, I think it makes perfect sense. They want the Jews to cease so they can fire.
Very good. But, you know, these people, they turn up and they make very clear threats to the society. Why do the police in cities like London, why are they so weak, apart from their direction?
And I've seen them asking people to remove Union flags in Scotland, asking one gentleman to cover up his Star of David.
Yeah, it just happened the other day. And these people, these police, if you see, they're scared. They're outnumbered. If they went in and arrested the big bearded man shouting for jihad on the streets, they'd have a riot on their hands. I think they should go and arrest him. I think they should get more and more policemen. They should go in with riot shields and they should go and arrest the bugger. But anyway, the point is that if that person is calling for violence on the streets, as they clearly are, that will have an effect, particularly on weak people, weak leaders. It will have an effect. Whereas the people who are nice and decent and respectful and thank the police officers after the demonstration, they might impress them with their courtesy, but they're not going to terrify them into action.
Douglas, it's disturbing to think that part of the job of trying to tell Israel's story is happening not happening on an even playing field, because there is so much violent intimidation happening on the other side, and still trying to persuade the media through respectful and peaceful language. I want to talk to you a little bit about the media atmosphere.
You can do respectful, I'll do peaceful.
You know, it's becoming increasingly difficult to be respectful when coming up against the sheer deluge of lies and vitriol.
Oh, I know. I mean, every day we have to shovel through huge steaming piles of horse shit.
It is. and it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain that facade of being passive aggressive. I want to show you one example, actually, because I think sometimes people don't understand how the media will manipulate things against us. This was an exchange I had just the other day on Channel 4 with Krishnan Gurumurthy, who was asking me about the 13 UNRWA staff members who participated in the October 7 massacre. Mm. And he asked me, have you presented the evidence to the United Nations and other parties? And I said, I personally do not know. I'm not privy to what intelligence has been passed between our agencies. Continue to harangue, so you don't know, you don't have evidence, you don't have evidence, you don't have evidence. And I pushed back and I said, I can't speak specifically to that, but that's the tip of the iceberg of the collusion and complicity between UNRWA and Hamas, because there was literally a Hamas server farm underneath UNRWA headquarters, leeching its electricity. And he pushes back and, well, let's have a watch and see how that exchange went. This was cut from the broadcast interview. They put it up online after I complained.
Oh.
I can tell you what we did expose this week. We revealed that Hamas had been running a massive server farm, the nerve center of its intelligence operations, from a bunker 20 meters underneath the UNRWA compound in Gaza. Not only that, it had been leaching electricity.
Can we stick to these allegations? Well, because again, these are claims that you're making. They can't be confirmed.
No, these aren't claims that we're making, Krishnan. No, we took journalists.
They are literally claims that you're making, and they can't be verified.
The New York Times. Let's stick to Krishnan, the New York Times was one of many international media outlets that was embedded with the Israeli army and went to see and photograph for themselves the Hamas server farm underneath UNRWA's compound in Gaza.
So he keeps hammering back on this very specific point. When I said, look, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, AP, AFP, they were all there. They went to see it for themselves. And one of the challenges then is that I find anything the Palestinians say will automatically and uncritically be parroted, including casualty numbers presented by Hamas. The same Hamas that claims to have destroyed 1,000 Israeli tanks didn't happen. Whereas anything that Israel says is, Israel claims we haven't been able to independently verify it. These are just claims you're making, even when these are claims in which the international... Why do you identify within the Western media this proclivity to accept uncritically what the Palestinians say, and anything Israel says is always treated much more suspect?
First of all, I don't want Christian Guru Murphy over my shoulder this much longer.
Fixed.
Yeah. It was unnerving me. One explanation for that is what's known as Moynihan's Law. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late great Democrat senator, had a term which he used when he was ambassador to the United Nations in the 70s, which was that There is an intrinsic problem in democracies and countries that respect human rights, which is that these countries, are countries in which human rights abuses get reported. In time, he pointed out, it's possible that since you do not hear of human rights abuses in countries that do not care about human rights, you will only hear about them in the countries that do. Mm. And in time, you may come away with the idea that the countries that most abuse human rights are the ones that abuse them the least.
Because they report them.
Because they report them. Right. So, for instance, when Israel makes any mistake on the battlefield, it's out there. There's, you know, nothing you can do. Like that horrible, tragic incident with the three hostages who were shot.
Yeah. I mean, and by the way, sometimes I find, and it's extremely painful for me, when interviewers bring up the three hostages who were tragically shot by our forces. And sometimes when they tell me those three hostages were killed by Israeli forces, it feels malicious.
It is. You're right.
It is malicious.
It's malicious. It's malicious. Of course. They say they even killed their own.
Why do they do that?
Because they want to hurt you. They want to hurt you.
Why?
You're a Jew and you're a Zionist.
And that explains why in Western media outlets they raise this very sensitive point as if to...
Let me dig down deeper on that, just because it's an interesting corner there. Why do they say genocide in Gaza?
Because it's been the wet dream of every anti-Semite since the end of the Holocaust to haul the Jews up in an international court on charges that they are the true Nazis.
Sure. And to hurt you. When they call you the new Nazis, why would they do that? Of all the figures in history to seize upon, why do they do Nazis? Because they want to hurt you. They want to wound you as deeply as possible. And they have chosen these weapons in the knowledge that it's how you hurt Jews. That's why. They've been doing it for years. They've been doing it for years. They could easily choose something else to do or to say, some other analogy to pull up, if there's a mistake on the battlefield. They were thrilled, a lot of the international media, at that awful, unimaginable thing. Can you imagine the soldiers who made that mistake? Can you imagine
what
how they live with themselves? There were more than three casualties there. The three poor young men who were killed and the person responsible for killing them. At least sympathy should be due in such a situation. But
and
no,
I find that we've
there
lost
was a
sympathy.
Sort of glee. Yes. Because of this dynamic we're getting to the root of here, this dynamic of what do you actually want here? Do you want Israel to win? Do you want them to draw or do you want them to lose? For instance, very, very important dynamic. But this one about believing Hamas and not believing Israel, it's an extension of something I've seen all my life covering the conflicts in this region, which is that it's just a lot easier to take that view. It's a lot easier to take Hamas's body count figures and just report them. You know, a bomb landed an hour ago, 500 people are dead, strangely round number, considering it took months for Israel to work out how many people were killed on the 7th of October, because it takes time. But there's a reason why people accept that figure, those figures, and they accept them because it's a lot easier than sending your own journalists into an incredibly dangerous area with an incredibly dangerous group of people, Hamas, and trying to verify it.
To the credit of the international media, they do press on the question of why their journalists are not allowed independent access into Gaza, and the Israeli Supreme Court has already ruled on that issue because of fears about exposing troop movements.
Yeah, and but the point with this is, if they do want to go like that, they know how dangerous it would be. If you're a Western journalist, you can put your life in the hands of the IDF and embed with the IDF in Gaza, as I've done, or you could try to go in with Hamas, and you better keep your fingers crossed.
And then we've seen in previous conflicts as well where they then will never release footage when the journalists have been in Gaza, never release footage of dead Hamas terrorists, never release footage of rockets being fired from the middle of urban areas, because they know that Hamas will dictate the terms of what they can let out of Gaza. And they know in this war as well that the information coming out of Gaza is what Hamas wants them to
but
see.
I've seen this all my life in this conflict. I have a friend who's a Palestinian journalist, lives in Jerusalem, who you probably know, who can't go to the West Bank since he was rude about Yasser Arafat many years ago, and you know, exposed his corruption and so on. It was made perfectly clear to my friend that he was, if you come back, you'll be hanged from a lamppost. Well, Palestinian journalists learn from that sort of thing. I can't help...
And therefore self-censor.
Yes, yes. And Palestinian journalists in Gaza, are you joking? By contrast, I mean, I do notice that the Israeli media is not shy about being rude about Benjamin Netanyahu or indeed any other politician.
They speak, as we say, frankly.
They speak frankly, and good luck to them. That's what it's like being in a noisy democracy. But again, we should be aware of the vulnerability here. The mistake can arise that Israel is the one in the tricky situation, the wrong situation. Look, even Haaretz says this about the prime minister.
Right.
Ah, what do the Palestinians say about their leadership? Oh, they seem fine with it.
Yes, and I've had that in a BBC interview where they quoted a Chaim Levinson piece saying that the IDF is putting lipstick on nonsense. And the BBC journalist asked me, that is what you are doing. You are putting lipstick on nonsense. Fairly bizarre accusation
to
place.
It's a weird phrase.
Yes, a very weird phrase, very weird phrase. But look, another of the things that I'm finding, speaking with the international media, that's very difficult to get this point across. We have actually a clip, I think one of the first viral moments that you had in this war, speaking about the question of proportionality. Let's watch this.
By the way, this is terribly, like, this format is very much like This Is Your Life.
We'll do, let's do another one of those in 40 years.
I've always thought that the whole idea of proportionality in conflict is absurd. It's something which I think Western countries and the UN, who always gang up on Israel whenever Israel is attacked, it's something that these people always obsess about only in the case of Israel. What is proportionate in a conflict? Proportionate in this conflict would mean that the response to the massacre of more than 1,000 Israelis in cold blood by Hamas a couple of weeks ago should be responded to by Israel by sending Israeli forces to rape exactly the same number of women as Hamas raped and to decapitate exactly the same number of babies as Hamas decapitated and to steal hundreds of Palestinians and hold them in dungeons and torture them as Hamas did. I mean, it's obscene to even think in these terms, and yet that's what proportionality would mean.
This is one of the things that I'm having difficulty with, and it comes up in every interview as the death toll, whatever it may be, rises. And there is clearly a great deal of suffering in Gaza, which we don't belittle or downplay for a moment. But I say they ask me, you know, why is this happening? How long is the killing going to continue? And I say, look, we didn't want this war. We didn't start this war. We didn't expect this war. Hamas declared war on us. None of this would be happening if Hamas had not declared this war and if it were not fighting using the evil strategy of deliberately and strategically embedding itself under civilian areas. And I had this argument in a Sky News interview with Yalda Hakim as well. I said, you are falling into Hamas's trap.
Yeah.
When you take this suffering and you blame Israel instead of the terror organization that launched this war, that is deliberately fighting this war from inside hospitals and under graveyards and tunnels under schools, you are playing into the strategy of the terror organization that is happy for the suffering to be disproportionate because it pulls on your heartstrings. Mm. And generates the pressure that will let Hamas escape this war on its feet. To me, this point is so obvious, maybe because I've said it in 250 interviews. Why am I struggling to get that message across?
I don't know if you are struggling with it or not.
Well, if you think the message is getting through, then that would definitely give me a nice boost of motivation.
I hope it's getting through. It'll get through with some people. It'll get through to those with ears to listen, you know. And I hope there are quite a lot of them.
But are they listening?
Well, I believe that there are still some, a majority, I think. But I would just add again, I say something you probably wouldn't, but I have a slightly harder line on this, which is that I believe that that the people of Gaza have a responsibility for voting in Hamas when they had an opportunity not to. They voted in Hamas, knowing what Hamas are. They allowed Hamas to carry out the coup, killing Fatah and other Palestinians and dragging their bodies behind trucks in the West Bank, in Gaza. They didn't overthrow the government. You might say, well, that's a lot to expect. Well, it was always a lot to expect. Everywhere in the world that overthrew a despotic terrorist government, it was always a lot to expect. But okay, they didn't do that. They allowed 18 years, exactly the time you need to educate a child, for Hamas to indoctrinate a new generation, not of psychopaths, because you can't make psychopaths, but you can make sociopaths. 18 years is the time you need to create a sociopath. So they voted for Hamas, allowed Hamas to carry out the coup, didn't overthrow them, allowed them to indoctrinate an entire generation of sociopaths in Gaza. They then start a war, and they want this to... They want this is Israel's fault. Israel has to respond in exactly the correct way. I'm sorry, I treat the Palestinians in Gaza in the same way I would treat any other group that produced a horror like that. They're responsible for their actions. They're responsible for their actions. We held the German people responsible for the fact that they voted in the Nazis and did not get them out. We held them responsible. And we, the Allies, in the Second World War, did things that Israel would never dream of doing.
And by the way, it's a good thing that since the Second World War, the world created a system of international law to mitigate the horrors of war. We have no problem with international law. We enforce it, uphold it. The only question is, is it real international law that we are being expected to adhere to, or rules that NGOs have made up to try to make it impossible for Israel to win a war?
Well, we know the answer to this, because Israel was dragged to The Hague and is not guilty of the things they were being accused of.
In fact, is the victim of the things that it was accused of.
I'm sorry, you know, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine with no justification and has destroyed a generation of young Ukrainians.
Yeah.
The current enlistment age in the armed forces in Ukraine for the defense is people in their 40s. This is a disaster for a country. Now, why do people not talk about this as much as they talk about Israel? Funnily enough, Vladimir Putin doesn't much care if you think he's following the laws of war or not. I was in Kherson when he was shelling it still. And the Russian way of war, I can tell you from having seen it, is very brutal. Very brutal. But Vladimir Putin doesn't care if an NGO comes at him with human rights abuses. We come back to the Daniel Patrick Moynihan problem. Israel is partly vulnerable because Israel does care about that accusation. And there will in time be the risk that the countries that don't care look like the ones that do, and the ones that do care look like they're the ones that don't.
What do you mean?
It's the same paradox you come back to, which is if you actually do care about the laws of war, they will be used against you. If you don't care about them, everyone realizes you're just somebody who doesn't care.
Well, we do have to care about the laws of war and take them very seriously. The problem is...
I think we all do. I think every Western democracy does. But you can only do so if you, at the same time, say and recognize there is country after country in the world today that would stand as judge, juror, and executioner over this country that has no moral right to do so because they don't follow these rules.
Absolutely.
Don't judge a country by rules that you don't follow.
Not only rules you don't follow, rules you don't even think apply to you because they create all these invented new standards to try to... It's not even a double standard, I think, as the Prime Minister said. It's a triple standard. One rule for the democracies, one rule for the dictatorships, another for Israel.
Yeah.
Douglas, it really feels like this moment is an inflection point. October 7th is a watershed moment where everything will change. Nothing will be as it was before. We haven't even begun to internalize how things are going to change. But I'm wondering, for you personally, how do you think that massacre and what has happened with your career since then, the personal journey that you've been through, how has this changed you? How has it changed perhaps how the world sees you?
I have no idea particularly how the world sees me. And if I spent any time thinking about that, I wouldn't get up in the morning.
I don't know. I think you have a lot to get up in the morning.
I never find self-reflection all that important or useful. I just do my work. I think I had a pretty good idea of what the jihadists intended. And I've seen it up close enough times. So I wasn't surprised by the brutality of Hamas. I was not that surprised by the response either, because it's what also I expect.
You weren't surprised?
No, one of the reasons I came here as soon as I could, for instance, was that I knew that we'd have denial. I just knew it. I knew it. I knew they'd lie. I knew that they'd cover it up. And I've always found in my career that it's very useful to see things with your own eyes, because among other things, you will live to see people who claim you didn't see what you saw. And you're better girded if you've seen.
And in the context of that denial, do you think that what has been happening around the world since October 7th, I mean, is the West going to continue down some sort of anti-Semitic rabbit hole, or are we going to see the pendulum swing? And will it swing to somewhere sane, or will it swing more violently in another direction?
My prediction has always been that the aim of Western governments in relation to the Islamist threat that Israel faces, and which we all face, is to try to avoid a point of clarification, by which I mean that it becomes as clear a conflict as it could become. Israel can no longer live in that point of unclarity, and I don't think most of the Israeli people want to live in a delusion.
No, it's a moment where a lot of things have become very clear. Actually.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these people said these things and then they did them again, and
maybe you should take them seriously.
Yeah, we remembered that they meant it, you know. And, you know, as I've said in countless interviews, as I'm sure you have, that, you know, I mean, everybody at the Nova Party would have dreamed of the day that they could dance with their Palestinian neighbors. And, you know, they weren't given the chance because their Palestinian neighbors came in and massacred them and raped them. So that puts a lot of your delusions to rest quite easily. The rest of the West sleeps and dreams, you know. Occasionally it gets a little bit of a wake-up call.
Do you think this was a wake-up call that is going to change something fundamental?
No. My suspicion has always been that what would happen would be that there would be a period before the moment of clarification in which Israel would be blamed for causing the problem in the other countries, which is what I think we're going through at the moment. So it's much easier, for instance, for David...
Israel is now being accused of...
causing the problem.
Causing the problem, yeah. Being...
Because Israel is defending herself.
Right.
It will be blamed for defending itself because it's causing domestic political problems in other countries. So
This and is if Israel what... didn't defend itself, there would be less cause for political unrest in other countries where Israel has become this rallying cry.
It's a big problem. I've seen this conundrum all my life. There are some people who think that you should not respond to terrorism because if you respond to terrorism, you cause terrorism. It's a logical circle.
Yes, I've seen that when I've said Hamas wants war, they say, so why are you giving it what it wants? Well, because destroying Hamas is the only way to make sure that Hamas can never act on its wants
ever
again.
Yeah, we're not turning them from a peacenik organization into a terror group.
Right,
yeah.
It's not like turning the other cheek is suddenly going to make Hamas lay down its arms.
No, and so, as I say, I've always thought there'd be a period in which Israel was at a point of vulnerability internationally because, and I think it is in this point at the moment, David Cameron, Lord Cameron, sorry to you and me, Kamala Harris, Anthony Blinken and others, they have these domestic problems on the streets. They know that it's actually a domestic security problem as well as a potential political problem for them in the forthcoming elections. And so they double down on criticizing Israel and will demand that Israel gives the Palestinians another state as a reward for October the 7th. If that doesn't work, they do that. They want to pacify the problem they have at home. And that might buy them a few years. I don't know, maybe. Maybe it'll buy them a few months. Maybe a decade. Who knows? But the people who stand up in mosques in the UK and incite violence against my country, incite violence against Jews, incite violence against minorities, yeah, I'm against them. And in our era, there's this very clever trick, which, as you know, was originated by the Muslim Brotherhood, which was to call this rational fear of an element of Islam a phobia. It's not a phobia at all. It's a totally reasonable fear. My colleagues across the continent in Europe who've been shot by jihadists for crimes like blasphemy did not have an irrational fear of Islam. They had a totally rational fear, which turned out to be correct.
Select
elements within Islam. But then you get to the old problem of how big a number. Why is it that ex-Muslims are the ones in their community who fear violence against themselves? Where are the Muslims who would call that out? Where are the Muslims who turn around and say to their co-religionists, how stupid are you to want to create violence because of a cartoon? That doesn't matter at all. We have freedom of thought. Where are those Muslims? I mean, there was a group some years ago in the UK set up called Muslims Against Anti-Semitism, and somebody came to me and said, do you know this group? I said, yeah, I know that guy. Good guy. We had dinner the other night.
Was it as small as that?
Yeah. It was one guy. My point is that I will not have an accurate, to my mind and to many of my readers' minds, has been an accurate prediction of the path my society is going down turned into a phobia, and an accurate assessment of the situation in my country turned into a prejudice. It is not.
It's interesting you said that, because actually here in Israel, I'm fairly optimistic what we've seen since the October 7th massacre with so many Arab citizens of Israel, including Muslims, who were so horrified by what happened that the level of their identification with Israel went up, because they all took a look at it and said, oh my God, I want absolutely nothing to do with that. And it strengthened their Israeli identity.
Absolutely. And I think the point is that happens when the crocodile is that near the boat. When it's that near the boat, that would happen. You can find...
No Muslim leaders in Israel want to be associated directly or indirectly with the horrors that Hamas perpetrated.
But this is the same thing with secularists who left Iran. Societies which are ruled by this horrible extreme Islamist ideology are a catastrophe everywhere. And some Muslims get very, very badly burned by it. They're usually the first victims of it. But I would like those people to stand up. I'd like them to stand up against terror. I'd like them to realize this comes for them as well. Too many of them think, I'll keep my head down, I'll keep out of the way. And I think that also is a shameful position to be in. So no, I don't accept that there's any phobia or anything like that in any of this. I think that there is a serious problem in Western societies with people who believe an utterly fascistic ideology. The one place, so you must just make this point, there's another point of history, but the one place in the world at the end of the Second World War where a Nazi returned home and was celebrated in triumph was where?
Oh, that's a good question. The one place where a Nazi returned home and was Gosh, I don't know.
Egypt.
Who?
The Grand Mufti.
Huh.
Al-Husseini returns from prison in Yugoslavia, where he was not prosecuted in 46. He's detained. The CIA actually was listening to Egyptian public radio, and so we have a transcript of what was said when he, the head of the Nazi battalion in this neck of the woods, when he returns home. Everywhere else in the world, a Nazi in 1946 slinked away. They went to live in South America.
And by the way, do you know which was the only European country whose Jewish population grew during the Second World War?
Yes, I do know that.
Muslim Albania.
Yeah.
Muslim Albania.
So, but hang on, the point I have is, the point is that when he returned home, everyone else, Eichmann, all these people, they all go to South America and go under different names. The Mufti returns to Egypt, and Egyptian public radio says, the lion of the Muslims, the scourge of the Jews, has returned to us.
That's an honorific, the scourge of the Jews.
This was the one part of the world where somebody involved in the genocide of the Second World War against the Jews of Europe returned home as a victor and a hero. And that has consequences. And I would like to see that strain torn out of society in this region. And if the people of the region did that, and if Muslims in the West did that, I would be their first supporter, praiser, and ally. But I'm waiting for that day to come.
Yeah, unfortunately, to quote former President Gay of Harvard, it depends on the context, the question of when the whole timeline begins. We point to October 7th. Others say, well, actually, 1967. But when you look at the much broader picture of the alliance between radical Islam and the most fascistic elements of European politics, it goes much deeper. Douglas, it's a fascinating historical discussion. We could go on and on. Just before we wrap up, I want to play a quick game with you, a rapid-fire game. We're calling it Decoding Douglas, okay?
Do you play this with all your guests?
Yes, all of them. We all ask some questions about Douglas Murray. You're famous.
It's not going to work as a gimmick.
No, I don't know. We've done it with several guests already. No, I'm kidding. Look, you're famous for trying to point out certain contradictions within modern society. And some people might think that you're something of a contradiction or an enigma yourself. So I want to raise a few things that I don't necessarily think are contradictions, but give me a sentence telling me whether you think that they're a contradiction or how they make sense in your mind. You are highly educated. You went to a fairly decent university in Britain.
I tried.
And very critical yet of elite educational institutions.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, I think that I'm critical of elite educational institutions if they become rotten.
And were they not rotten when you were back at Oxford?
If they were at the time, I didn't notice it and it had no effect on me.
When do you think they went rotten?
Well, my belief, I left university in 2001, and in those days, university was sublimely non-political.
They've gone in a very different direction.
Yes. I mean, we used to buy a newspaper at the end of term and read it to see what had happened in the world.
Interesting.
Wonderful days.
Wonderful. Take me back. You're an avowed atheist?
Not an atheist. I call myself an agnostic.
An agnostic. Okay, so my producer team have helped me prep for this interview. Got the notes wrong. A proud agnostic, and yet...
I'm not a proud agnostic. I'm a natural doubter.
A natural doubter. And at the same time, the role of Judeo-Christian values plays a very important role in how you see the identity of the West.
Well, even somebody who isn't a firm believer is still a Christian. You still dream Christian dreams, tell Christian stories, live in the Christian aftermath, at the very least.
Without the theological framework.
This is a conundrum that I looked at in The Strange Death of Europe, because I see it as a wider existential issue for Western man.
You're quintessentially English.
I got a touch of New Yorker.
And yet you're spending so long here in the Middle East as well. Do you miss England's green and pleasant lands?
I do very much. I love being in Israel, particularly because I love being in a country which knows what it's doing. It's enormously edifying. I don't miss London most Saturdays because I don't like seeing my capital city bespoiled by hooligans trampling on over our war monuments and much more. I do miss the England that I think, the Britain I think we should be and can be again. But for that to happen, it would have to be that we woke up from the slumber. And who knows?
That's a discussion for another day. Douglas Murray, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining me here on State of a Nation.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of State of a Nation. As always, please subscribe and follow us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back soon with more insider discussions about the state of our nation. Thanks for joining.